Good morning, everybody. It's good to be with you this morning, and it's always a blessing to be with the Lord's people on the Lord's Day, but this is really special and really exciting for us to be able to meet some of the people who are supporting us in the work that we have ahead of us. It's been a little bit of a whirlwind of a trip. Got off the airplane, and Keith whisked us away to his favorite Subway and bought us sandwiches there, and then met up with Morgan, Kevin, and Ted, and just got to really have some conversation with your elders. And I just want to say, from the very beginning, when we began to have communication with the elders about the work ahead of us, Josh and I were just incredibly impressed with the thoughtfulness of their leadership, with the purposefulness that they have in using the Lord's money and planning and doing all the work that they have to do. And that first impression has really proven to be true, not only of them, but I think of this entire church that they're shepherding. We've been incredibly welcomed. We've been impressed by the hospitality, and I admire you for the work that you're doing here, and I'm so thankful that we have an association with you now. We've gotten the complete Indiana experience. Last night, we learned a card game called Euchre, which apparently is all the rage here, and we were sprouting points. We were in the barn milking cows, and I'm still talking cards, but that sounds like nonsense to me, but it was, I think you know what that's all about, and that was really exciting, and so that was fun, being with the Turners. But again, I just want to say I really appreciate the invitation to be here for this weekend and to be with you. I think there's something really special about having fellowship with each other and having some sort of a relationship with each other. That the fellowship that we have is not merely financial, though we very much appreciate that, but it is the support, it is the prayers, it is the relationship that we know that we have with you. And the question's been asked a couple of times if we would be open to having people come see us out there, and yes does not seem adequate, of course. We would love for you to come, and I don't know what kind of space we could offer, like a mattress in the kitchen, but I'm sure the apartments will be very small, but we would love for you to come visit and see what we're doing there. So as Morgan's explained, Josh and I are very similar looking, but we've agreed that you can call me Josh number one, and he will be Josh number two. But he'll speak to you tonight, and he will tell you more specifics about just some of the plans that we have for the city and what our timeline looks like. But he's planning to move in April, May, and I'm planning to move in June. And so my family will be right behind him. So I have a wife, Katie, and a 10-month-old baby named Milo, and I'm missing him this morning. But hearing some of the cries and the baby sounds in the audience has been really encouraging too. So it's good to be with you, and I appreciate all of that. You can open up your Bibles to John 17, and that's where I want us to begin this morning. John 17. John 17 is a really special chapter because when we talk about the Lord's Prayer, I think oftentimes we mean the model prayer, where Jesus explains to his disciples, okay, when you pray, pray like this. But if we were going to be really accurate about what is the Lord's Prayer, John 17 is it. Jesus is in the garden on the night that he's betrayed, and he is just pouring his heart out to the Father. And if you've ever prayed that way, you probably know that those prayers that flow from your heart are maybe not like the most organized prayers, they're not the most scripted, but they can be the most meaningful. And really, that's the kind of prayer that I see Jesus praying. And I think that there's somewhat of a basic organization to it, that if you look at the first few verses, he talks about his relationship with the Father, and then the next few verses, he talks about his relationship with his disciples, and then he gets down towards the end and he says, and God, I'm not only praying for these, but I'm praying for all of those who will come to believe in your name. And so Jesus was praying for us so many years ago in that garden. And Jesus makes, I think, five basic petitions in this prayer where he's asking the Father for specific things for his disciples, for those immediate disciples then and for us as disciples now. And you can sort of like break those apart and say, well, he prays for this and he prays for that and he prays for this thing. But it's almost like this big ball of yarn that if you start pulling at it, you see that they're all connected and that one thing leads to another and you can't totally separate them from each other. But there are a number of things that I think jump out. And what I want to do is just briefly look at some of those to sort of build the point that I want to talk about. And I'll go ahead and tell you that the name of this lesson is the glory of discipleship. The glory of discipleship. But let's look at what Jesus prays for his disciples, and then maybe we can understand what that means and get to that. One of the things that Jesus prays for in this prayer is for God to keep his disciples safe. He prays for that like in verse 11, where he says, I am no longer in the world, but they are in the world, and I am coming to you. Holy Father, keep them in your name, which you have given me, that they may be one even as we are one. While I was with them, I kept them in your name, which you have given me. I have guarded them, and not one of them has been lost, except the son of destruction, that the scripture might be fulfilled. But now I am coming to you, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them your word, and the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. I do not ask that you take them out of the world, but that you keep them from the evil one. And so there's a lot of things that are wrapped up in that, but basically Jesus's prayer is, God, I was with them on earth and I was helping them and they were doing things like trying to be the greatest in the kingdom and I was having to say things like, get behind me, Satan, but I'm not going to be there now and so I'm worried about them. And notice that when Jesus prays for the safety of his disciples, that he's not praying for physical safety. He realizes that their ultimate enemy is not some government or some physical enemy or some weapon, but it's Satan. It's the evil one. And I think maybe that helps us to kind of focus on what's important, is that Jesus was not really all that concerned with physical safety, but he prays for the Father to keep his disciples safe from the evil one. We also read in verse 13 that he says that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves, which is similar to what Jesus had said in chapter 14, in verse 27, when he said, peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. And the thing that's interesting about that is here you have this man who is the man of sorrows, who's acquainted with grief, and a lot of people would look at Jesus' life and say, that's not a life that looks very peaceful. He died a violent death. That's not a life that looks very joyful. He was constantly rejected and going through so much pain and sorrow. And yet, he prayed for his disciples to have his peace and his joy. And I think that Jesus, again, has something much more real in mind than just like the pleasures of money or the earthly security or comforts that this world has to offer. Jesus wanted his disciples to have a sort of joy that was transcendent. A joy that would ultimately reach its peak in the words, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your Lord. He wanted his disciples to know the fulfillment. He wanted them to know the deep and satisfying joy that comes from doing the Father's will. And connected with that, Jesus prayed for his disciples' sanctification. If you look in verse 16, he says, they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them in the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, so I have sent them into the world. And for their sake, I consecrate myself, that they also may be sanctified in truth. You know, when we talk about the word sanctified or sanctification, I think a lot of times it's easy for us to just sort of simplify it and say, well, to be sanctified means to be set apart. And that's right. It has to do with being holy and with being different and being just sort of like set aside. But it's more than that. Sanctification means being set aside for a purpose. Jesus was praying that his disciples would be different, but not just for the sake of being different, but that they would be different because they were active in doing the Father's will. You know, I think that this helps us to understand that our view of Jesus' work in us can be really limited sometimes. Sometimes I think that we just sort of simplify it and we water it down and we think, okay, Jesus has saved us, Jesus has forgiven us, but why has he done that? And when we start to see when Jesus speaks these things and prays these things, we see that Jesus isn't interested in just saving us to save us. That God doesn't want to just forgive us, but he wants to use us. And that's a great and powerful truth of this. He also prays for his disciples' unity as you get down into like verse 20. He prays in verse 21 that they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us so that the world may believe that you've sent me. And so Jesus is praying that these people who come to believe in Jesus and come to follow him would have this unity that would be so profound and so otherworldly that people of the world would look at them and say, these people have a lot of differences. They come from different cultures. They may have different ideas, different personalities, different interests. But the thing that they have in common is so much more important to them than the things that might set them apart. And so the prayer is like reaching its crescendo here towards the end of the chapter where he's saying things like, God, even as me and you are one, Jesus said that, I want these people to be one. He had high hopes for us. I mean, he's not letting any of us get out of here without being convicted, I think, of what his desire is and the heights that he's calling us to. And the thing that he says is that if we would sort of just figure this out and do this, that it would be evidence to the world that what Jesus has done in our lives is real. That what we have in common with each other because of him is so much more important than politics or sports or income or education or any of that garbage that can make us be different. But then finally, Jesus prays for his disciples to be with him forever. And this is really where the prayer just soars. In verse 24, he says, Father, I desire that they also, whom you have given me, may be with me where I am to see my glory that you have given me, because you loved me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, even though the world does not know you, I know you, and these know that you sent me. I made known to them your name, and I will continue to make it known, that the love with which you have loved me may be in them, and I in them. And so Jesus' ultimate prayer of prayers is, he says, look, Father, I want you to protect them and keep them safe. I want you to allow them to have my joy. I want them to be sanctified. I want them to be united. But ultimately, I want all of that to reach its culmination where they live with me. I want them to see me where I am in your presence. And I want them to see my glory. Have you ever thought about what that'll be like? What will it be like to see Jesus in his glory? I mean, I can only imagine that it'll be staggering, and we have glimpses. We have glimpses, like Isaiah chapter 6, where he sees this throne, and he sees these seraphim that are surrounding the throne of God, and they're covering themselves because they're shielding themselves from the holiness of God, and they're shouting, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. The whole earth is filled with his glory. We have scenes like Ezekiel chapter 1, and we have scenes in Daniel and in Revelation where these righteous men glimpsed a little part of God's glory and they fell on their faces. And one day we'll see Jesus. And I can only imagine that, like Thomas, the only thing that we'll be able to say at that point is my Lord and my God, and it'll just be staggering. And so when you look at this, this is what Jesus prayed for us. He prayed that we would be protected from the evil one, that we would have joy, that we would have unity, that we would be sanctified, and that one day we would be with him in glory, that we would see him as he is. But what does this prayer have to do with the glory of discipleship? And what do I mean by that? Well, I want you to notice that the prayer begins and ends with the intrapersonal glory of God and how we can share it. And I'll explain what I mean by that. So in chapter 17 and verse 1, he says, when Jesus had spoken these words, he lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you. And so you see that within the Godhead, within God, he's saying, Father, glorify me as I've glorified you. There's this intrapersonal glory of God. But then look down in verse 22, towards the end, and he says, the glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one. And so I think the thing that makes is really the theme of this prayer and ties all of these petitions together is that idea that Jesus is saying, the glory that I have with you, glorify me, I glorify you, but I want my disciples to also have that glory. And so what is Jesus' glory? What is this glory that he wants to share with us? Well, I think he explains it. If you look in verse 4, he says, I glorified you on earth, having accomplished the work that you gave me to do. And so Jesus talks about a glory that he had that's not just this future glory, but it's a glory that's this present glory on earth, or in his case now, a past glory in a sense, because he had been glorifying Jesus or been glorifying God with his life. And what Jesus says is, the glory that I had, my glory, was doing the work that you gave me to do. It was being obedient. It was fulfilling the mission that I had. Well, what was the work that Jesus was given to do? Look in verse 6. I have manifested your name to the people whom you gave me out of the world. Yours they were, and you gave them to me, and they have kept your word. And then if you look down in verse 26, he says, I made known to them your name, and I will continue to make it known, that the love with which you have loved me may be in them, and I in them. And so when Jesus talks about the glory that he had, and the glory that he had in doing the work that the Father had given to him, that work was to manifest the name of God in verse 6. It was to make known to them God's character and God's nature and his name in verse 26 as well. And so that's why John chapter 1 begins by telling us, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But then down in verse 14, it says that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory is of the only begotten. And so Jesus' glory is in his representation of God, his representation of God's character to the world that was watching him. That's why Jesus could say things like, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. In John chapter 14, Philip says, Jesus, show us the Father and it's enough. And I've always thought, like, Jesus probably should have just, like, given him a little smack. It's like, what do you mean? Of course that would be enough. Show us the Father. But what Jesus said was, If you've seen me, you've seen the Father. That was his work. That was his mission. It was to manifest the Lord. It was to manifest God's character to a world that was watching him. And so to do that, Jesus came into the world, but he wasn't of the world. And he was the light of the world. He was so different than the darkness that surrounded him that he shone as light. But you notice that those very same things that Jesus said about himself were things that he also said to his disciples. In John 17, he says, "As you have sent me into the world, so I've sent them into the world." Jesus said things like, "I am the light of the world." And he also turned to his disciples and said, "You are the light of the world." We read about Jesus being the high priest, and we read about us being a royal priesthood. And so the work that Jesus had, the glory that Jesus had to represent God's character and God's nature to the world is the work that he's now given to us to carry on in his name. That's the glory of discipleship that we can have right now. And so each of these petitions has to do with being in the world, but not of the world. And like Jesus, our mission is to become God's representation of himself to the world around us. That people could look at us and see some representation of the nature and the character of the Almighty. Now that's challenging. That's a pretty high thing to aspire to, but that's exactly what Jesus prayed for his followers to have. And what I want to propose to you is that this has always been God's intention for his people. From the very beginning, God has always wanted there to be a people that would reflect his nature and that would make his name manifest. And I want to prove that to you. Let's go all the way back to the beginning. Look in Genesis chapter 1. In Genesis chapter 1, we read some really famous verses about the creation of man. And look in verse 26. "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.'" So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And so we see this very famous phrase that when God created mankind, he made us in his image. And I think that when we read that, we shouldn't only see how he made us, but we should see why he made us. That God's intention was that mankind would be representations of him, that he could look down from heaven and see little figures of himself reflecting his nature and reflecting his character. Look over in Exodus chapter 19. Now in Exodus chapter 19, we fast forward several years and Israel is coming up out of Egypt. And this is the way God describes his intentions for this nation. What he wants them to be is really a sort of a strange description, but Exodus chapter 19 and verse 4. "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel." And so what God says in Exodus 19, he's like, "Okay, look, I've just brought you up out of Egyptian slavery, and I've got some ideas for you, and I've got some plans for you." And really the things that he says in Exodus 19 are very similar to the things that Jesus prayed in John 17. He says, "Look, I want you to be sanctified. I want you to be my people. You're going to be in the world, but not of the world. But there's going to be a purpose behind that. And what Jesus, or what God says in Exodus 19 is, I want you to be like this kingdom of priests. And that's sort of a strange thing to say. But what is a priest? Well, a priest is somebody who is sort of like this intermediary, somebody who goes between God and man. And God set that up in the old law, you know, through the Levitical priesthood, that those of the tribe of Levi would serve as priests and they would have the priestly duties. But even before that, he says to the whole nation, I want all of you to be priests. What did he mean by that? Well, I think it's helpful to think about it this way, that, you know, on the Day of Atonement, for instance, the high priest would go into the holy place, the most holy place, and he would represent the people to God. And that's really what a priest would do, is he would be like speaking on behalf of the people, representing the people in the presence of God. But that's not all. Because the priest would also turn around and speak to the people. And at that point, the priest would represent God to the people. And so a priest does both. It was also reflected in the things that the priest would wear, and that's sort of interesting. That the priest, you can read about this in Exodus and Leviticus and Numbers, the high priest actually wore a crown. I mean, and he was just like all blinged out. I mean, you read all the jewels and gold and stuff that he had, that would have been enough to make any rapper jealous. I mean, he had all this stuff going on. And you read that and it's like, why did God tell the high priest to wear a crown? Why did God tell the high priest to wear jewelry and all of this flashy stuff? Well, it was because at that point when the high priest spoke to the people, he was representing God to the people. But when he went into the most holy place on the Day of Atonement, you know what he would do? He would take all of that stuff off. He would take off the crown, he would take off the jewelry, he would take off all of the flashy things. And he would dress only in his linen tunic, like a slave. Because it was at that point that he went before God and he represented the people to God. And so I want you to see that and think of that, that a priest really does both things, that he represents the people to God, but he also represents God to the people. And so what God is saying to this nation, Israel, is, I want you to be priests. I want you to represent me. I want you to make my name manifest to the nations. I want other people to look at you and say, wow, what kind of a God do these people have for them to be a nation like this? You know the story. And you know that Israel failed magnificently. So much so that when God explains why they're taken into captivity in Ezekiel 26 and 27, he says, look, okay, I wanted you to be a people that the nations would look at and say, wow, we can see God in this people. But instead, the nations look at you and they're ashamed and they're embarrassed and you're doing things that not even they do. And Israel had really failed to live up to this role of a priesthood like they were called to. But you know that it's not just Israel that failed. Because just like Genesis 1 told us that we were all made in the image of God, Romans 3 and verse 23 says all have sinned. I'm sorry, it's present tense. All sin and fall short of the glory of God. And so because of sin, we fall short of the glory. The glory is that we get to represent God. We get to make his name manifest. But sin ruins that for us. But then here's the great message of the gospel, Hebrews chapter 2. Hebrews 2 tells us what Jesus has done for us. And in verse 10, it says it was fitting for it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. For he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will sing your praise, and again, I will put my trust in him, and again, behold, I and the children God has given me. And so, if you want to just like summarize the gospel in three verses, that's it. We were all made in the image of God. We've all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. But in Jesus, he's restored us to glory. He's allowed us to once again be who we were made to be, to have a purpose in this life that we were intended to have, to be representatives of God's nature and God's character. And so, 1 Peter 2 tells us, you are a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. And he talks about how that now God has not just said to the physical nation of Israel, I want you to be priests, but he said to us, spiritual Israel, those who share the faith of Abraham, you are my priesthood. I want you to represent me to the watching world. And so this is a high calling. Because the glory of discipleship means that God doesn't just want to save you, but he wants to use you. That he wants others to see him in you. And if you really think about it, I mean, all of life is a search for an identity and a purpose. That's why people work themselves to death in jobs. That's why people get so wrapped up in hobbies and interests that it just means the world to them. Because everybody is looking for an identity and a purpose. Everybody wants to know, who am I and what's my life about? And you realize that what God is saying is, you can have an identity and a purpose that's wrapped up in me. That my identity and my purpose can become your identity and your purpose. And it's the only identity and the only purpose that will last. And so there's no greater joy than that. There's no greater fulfillment. There's no greater purpose. To glorify God is to be glorified. That's the glory of Jesus. And that's why he could speak even of the cross as his glory. And so Jesus would say, I am the light of the world, but he would say to his disciples, you are the light of the world. Jesus is the high priest, we are the priesthood. Jesus is the exact imprint of the nature of God, Hebrews 1. But 1 Peter 2 tells us that we can also become partakers of the divine nature, that we can share in that nature as well. And so that is the intrapersonal glory of God and how we can share it. But as we start to bring this to a conclusion, I want to make this more real. Because it's easy, I think, to think about some of these things academically and just to say, okay, well, that's some good ideas. But these truths will change everything about the way that you live. I really believe that. That if we understood these things, if we believed these things, that there would be practical changes that would happen in every decision that we make in life about what our identity and what our purpose is. It's not just theoretical. And to make that point, I want to think about Paul's example. You realize in Acts chapter 18, Paul went to Corinth. Maybe one of the most shocking verses in the book of Acts that just simply says Paul went to Corinth. You've probably heard preachers talk about Corinth before. Corinth was a sailor's town, and it had all of the things you would expect in a sailor's town. The kind of entertainment that you would expect, the kind of drinking and revelries that you would expect. I mean, no self-respecting person would go to Corinth. Not for any purpose of pleasure or choice. You know, I gotta wonder if people maybe questioned that decision and thought, Paul, why would you want to go there? Why would you want to go there? Open your eyes. Do you see all of the horrible things that are going on? Do you see all of the overt sinfulness? Do you see all of the disregard for godliness? And I think Paul talked about that in places like 1 Corinthians 15. In 1 Corinthians 15, he writes about the reasons why he decided to live his life the way that he did. And in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 32, he says, "What do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought with beasts at Ephesus? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." What Paul says is this. He says, look, if you want to just sort of make sense of my life from this earthly perspective, it'll never work. If you try to just figure out why I'm doing what I'm doing based on what makes me comfortable or happy or whatever, it'll never make sense to you. I don't gain anything humanly speaking. But what Paul understood was the glory of discipleship. That there was merit in going to a place that was uncomfortable and scary and dark because he was representing God's nature and God's character to the people who were there. I think about when Paul decided to go to Jerusalem. And he even had brethren who were saying, "I don't know about that. I don't know if you should really go there because something could happen to you there." And Paul says, "What do you mean by weeping and breaking my heart? I'm ready not only to be in prison, but also to die there." And so Paul's life was full of sacrifice. It was full of suffering. But I think that his perspective is seen in places like 2 Corinthians 5. In verse 20, where he says, "We are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us." Paul understood that there was this glory of discipleship, this present glory of discipleship. That as much as he could represent God's nature and God's character and the way that he lived and the things that he did, that that was glory to him. And his identity and his purpose was bound up in the identity and purpose of Jesus. Now I'll also say this. Paul understood the future glory of discipleship too. Paul hoped for what Jesus prayed for in John 17. That one day he could see him as he is and be with him in glory. He knew that one day Jesus' final petition would be fulfilled. That he would be with him. And let me show you where he puts both of those things together. Last passage, Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3. In verse 8. "Indeed, I count everything as loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him. Not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible I may attain the resurrection from the dead." You see, what Paul understood is that there was a present glory of discipleship in his life. That it didn't matter what he lost, it didn't matter how hard it was, it didn't matter what he had to give up, that the supreme thing, the most worthwhile thing, was gaining Christ. That if he could gain Christ and have fellowship with him, that anything that he gave up would not even be worth counting as a loss. That was glory. But Paul also understood the future glory in verse 11. That by any means possible, I may attain the resurrection from the dead. And I just gotta say, that changes everything. I mean, if we believe that we are going to live in heaven forever with the Lord, what is a moment in this life? What is anything that we choose to do that's hard or difficult? Will that even be a thought 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, in eternity? I want you to think about it this way. Why is it that you want to go to heaven? And let me maybe illustrate it this way. Think about this. If I could offer you an opportunity to go to a place that had every amenity that you wanted, where the euchre games never ended, where the fish always were biting, where your belly was always full, the weather was always nice, and there was no sorrow, no sadness, no cancer. Just imagine a place that has all of those things that you want, and you can have that, but Jesus isn't there. Would that be enough for you? That's challenging to think about. Because I think that if we're real with ourselves, sometimes we sort of just miss what it's all about. We miss what heaven, what makes heaven heaven. And we think of all of those sorts of things. And we've got to get to a place in our spiritual maturity where there's not even a hesitation. Where if that's the offer, we say, no, that won't be enough to gain Christ. That's glory. And I'll tell you what. When we understand that glory is gaining Christ in eternity forever, that's the future glory that we hope for, we'll realize that the present glory of this life isn't really that much different. It's to gain Christ. That nothing else that we achieve, nothing else that we get, nothing else that we gain is really gain at all if we don't have Him. And so the glory of discipleship is to gain Christ. We gain Him when we do the work that He did, when our lives represent God to the world around us. That's the present glory. But we gain Him in eternity when we're with Him where He is forever. And that's the future glory. And what that'll be like, I don't know. But I do know this. I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that's to be revealed to us. Whatever that means for you in your life, be willing to have that kind of perspective. Let's learn from Paul's example. Let's take Jesus' prayer to heart, and let's see that God has created us for a purpose, to have an identity that's bound up in His identity, and let's be people that represent God wherever we go. Let's go into places that are uncomfortable. Let's have conversations with our coworkers and our family that are awkward. Let's put ourselves outside of our comfort zones because that's what we were made for. We were made in the image of God. We've been redeemed so that we can be restored to that glory. And we have fellowship with Christ when we do the work that He did. He came into the world so that we can know something of God's nature and God's character. And so if you need to make your life right with God, the way that you can know Him is to know Jesus. Jesus says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. That man who prayed in the garden for you over 2,000 years ago is also God Himself. He's seated at the right hand of the throne of God. He lived and died so that you could be restored to glory, so that your life could have identity and purpose just like His. And if there's anything that you need to do to make your life right with God, I don't know this church very well. I'm visiting. But I can assure you I know them well enough to know that they would be overjoyed to help you do that. So if this church can help you make your life right with God, please come to the front. Let us know what your needs are while we stand and sing.